Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
As you will be aware, the issues that threaten social reality are often around the issues of sexuality. Ideological agendas are being pushed with greater intensity since the vote last year that saw changes to the Australian Marriage Act to recognise same-sex marriage. Well, this is not a unique thing to Australia, of course. It's happening throughout the Western world. The Australian Family Association has been working to clear the air around the hazy way that the national discussion has been unfolding around the issue of transgender. Now, they're sponsoring a national tour of a prominent paediatric endocrinologist, Dr. Quentin Van Meter, who is in Australia for a tour around our capital cities. He's addressing the issues in the transgender movement on his visit and shedding light on its origins and how social theory is trumping real science. Dr. Quentin Van Meter is a clinical associate professor of paediatrics at both Emory University and Morehouse Schools of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, in the USA. He's a fellow of the American College of Paediatricians, and he is our guest today. Dr. Quentin Van Meter, welcome along to 2020.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Quentin, you're on the line with us from Atlanta, Georgia, and it is early evening in the United States. I want to say thank you very much for staying up and lending your thoughts, your insights, your wisdom for our listeners today. You are coming to Australia, a guest of the Australian Family Association. Give us a little bit of an outline of what you're expecting to deliver to Australian audiences.
Well, I'll be talking on the subject of the origins of the transgender movement as it started in the United States, sort of felt a quiet fervor over in Europe for a while, and has since about 2007 erupted almost precipitously into a movement across the United States and indeed across the world. And I think without understanding where it came from and who the folks were who began this concept of transgenderism, it's important to understand the lack of science behind where they originated the ideas and how, again, as I say, I'm going to be talking about how science is being trumped by the social cult theory, really, of transgenderism across the world today. It's a very dangerous trend.
Okay, well, this gets very controversial as soon as we say the cult theory of transgenderism. And the way we talk about science in relation to all of that, let me ask you about your areas of expertise here, because you're bringing real authority when it comes to this issue of transgender, because you are an endocrinologist. Tell us about the work of an endocrinologist, and what is it that gives you this authority to be able to speak so powerfully into this issue of transgender?
Well, endocrinology is essentially the study of how hormones interact with receptors in the human body and how that brings around physiologic changes, primarily growth, pubertal maturation in the glandular systems in the body that regulate an incredible amount of how we survive on a day-to-day basis. So the big issue here is what is in the mind and what is in the body. So if we get back to the core issue, and my experience in this, of course, is because I have been trained and had a clinical practice for 40 years in dealing with how hormones work, how hormones change the body of growing children into young adults. And so the concept of moving from infancy, childhood through puberty to young adulthood is pretty much the meat and potatoes, if you will, of my clinical understanding and all of my clinical experience. So this idea of gender identity disorder, as it used to be called, and back in my fellowship days at Johns Hopkins in the late 1970s, it was actually called transsexualism. The word gender identity disorder was coined by Dr. Kenneth Zucker, a very prominent and very highly skilled clinical psychologist from Toronto. But before that, the word gender was stolen from a concept of naming genders of words in various languages throughout the world, and applied to the human being as sort of a, as Professor John Money at Hopkins called it, the internal sexed self, as he saw it. Now, Dr. Money is very interesting in that he was a clinical psychologist trained at Harvard, but he had no background in training in the concept of human sexuality, and he was a very aggressive, somewhat perverted individual, and I can say that without any concern about saying anything libelous, because I actually had interactions with him on a very regular basis as he taught us in our endocrine fellowship, and I was appalled then and continue to be appalled to this day about his theories and how he came about producing the concept of transsexualism as a valid scientific proposal. At no point in time is there any biologic evidence, any cellular evidence, any markers that can be reliably looked upon to identify someone who believes they are born into the body of the wrong sex. Sex is binary. It is not arbitrarily assigned by a physician in the delivery room as you're a boy or you're a girl. It is essentially determined at the moment of conception. You are either XX or XY. There are some times in nature where there are blends of XX and XY in the same human being, but they're exceedingly rare. And these patients who actually have these disorders of sexual differentiation most often, actually almost always, have no issues with their gender identity. They identify with the chromosome that their body has developed from the beginning in terms of maleness or femaleness. So the concept of gender identity disorder is that it was indeed a mental disorder. It is a delusional state where an individual who is a male believes their mind is actually that of a female, and that their body should be changed to essentially impersonate the female and physically, and likewise in males females who believe that they're born into the wrong body and wish to grow up and impersonate the body of a male. So, like many delusional states, or all delusional states, actually, there is essentially the treatment is to work the patient through the origins of the delusion and come out on the other side as a healthy individual who no longer lives in a delusional state. So this is where gender identity disorder was up until about 2 or 3 years ago, when the American Psychological Association committee that sort of goes through and reviews the coding of diagnoses decided to change gender identity disorder into gender dysphoria. It's playing with words to do a very significant amount of damage. If something is no longer a disorder, it is no longer an illness, and it's part of the normal spectrum. And so by taking the word disorder off the title, they ended up making dysphoria the title, which is essentially a medical term that says unhappiness and maladjustment. Okay, that's what dysphoria, a dysphoric state is, someone who is agitated or depressed over the fact that there is something wrong in their surroundings and they are maladjusting to it emotionally. So by doing so, they created an avenue for people who believe themselves to be born in the wrong body to no longer be abnormal, but to be suffering. And if you are suffering, then there is ability for the government or insurance agencies essentially to cover that, the cost of treatment, so that suffering can be alleviated. So instead of eliminating it entirely, they changed it so that the patients that believe they were born into the wrong body could get medical treatment, surgical treatment, as a relief of their anxiety and depression and agitation due to the fact they believe they were born in the wrong body. So we have an example of another delusional state is anorexia nervosa, where patients who are very skinny believe that they are morbidly obese and they starve themselves to death. They request surgeries to remove body fat when they have none. And or people who believe that they should be missing a limb and wish to have their leg or arm amputated so that they can live as an amputee, because they believe their limb is a diseased part of their body when it's perfectly healthy. No one would argue that those delusional states should not be treated by acquiescing and pretending the delusion is a normal state of health. So transgender identity disorder, as it was called by Dr. Kenneth Zucker, is still what it always has been. It's a mental delusional state, and the patients who feel this way should not be abandoned. They should be carefully evaluated for the root cause of what makes them feel like they are in the wrong body. And it's amazing the number of patients that have a deep psychological underpinning to their sense that they're born into the wrong body. Things as simple as a baby boy who grows up and then has a sibling who's a female who has a severe medical illness, and all the parents are focusing on that female child, the new one, and the boy senses that at age four, that the problem with him is that he's not a girl, that if he were a girl, he would get attention. And so that boy ends up wishing to be a female, starts acting like a female, dresses as a female, states to his parents that he is a female. Okay, that's something that is not uncommon in digging deeply into the psychological aspects of these children.
Quentin, let me just jump in here for a moment, and we'll continue on some of these. You're actually presenting incredible information, which feeds our understanding of the issue. Let me bring in here for a moment a spiritual dimension, because as Christians, we can see these things heating up in the culture around us, recognizing, and we can come back to a biblical foundation of being made in the image and likeness of God, man and woman, and you talked about that term binary. But let me just bring in here for a moment to get your opinion when it comes to a Christian response to this, because if it is just a condition that is something similar to anorexia, as you say, well, of course, we cannot have anything but compassion and throw our arms around people who are going through that state of delusional state that you describe. But this is a little bit different when we talk about gender identity disorder, now called gender dysphoria, because we wonder where we sit as Christians, because this is something that is contrary to what we'd understand is reality from God. What are your thoughts on the spiritual and how Christians approach the issue?
Well, I think even in the broader sense of, you know, as a Christian myself, the concept that natural law, essentially created by God, and is what rules all of science, and that there is no antithesis between science and religious faith, that they actually complement each other quite well. The idea that we can accept a gender disorder as normal goes against the nature of that. It goes against natural law or God's, you know, natural plan. So from a religious standpoint, it's an anathema. But we, as practitioners, try to do our very best not to proselytize. I know here I'm not necessarily an evangelist, so I use my faith in a way to essentially care for the suffering. And these kids are suffering mightily. And so as I am directed by my religious faith as a Christian, I wish to alleviate the suffering. And I know the pathway in my heart and in my mind, which is, it's a blend of all of my medical training and my spiritual upbringing, is, hey, you go after the disease state and you heal. And the healing is to bring this patient back to the reality as I see as God's plan. I do not wish to push that on the patient as a religious issue unless the patient asks me personally and says, hey, you know, or the parents would say, we are faithful Christians, and this is against our religion. And I would bolster their opinion with what's written in the Bible about the binary nature as God created us. But in the broader picture of trying to solve this across the world, there is so much that is essentially anti-religion that we paint a target on our back a lot if we bring that up as the very first issue. We practice our faith by example, and that's kind of how I learned to present myself to my patients, is if I am supposed to be living the life that Jesus Christ asked me to, I will faithfully do what I would expect him to have me do, and that is to heal these kids.
Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
An important conversation to give a little extra attention to today. Dr. Quentin Van Meter is our guest. We are talking about the very controversial issue of transgender, and you might like to participate in our conversation. Our talkback line open 1-800-316-316. Quentin, if I was just to outline for you, in Australia, it's very, very controversial. Even, in fact, our opposition, our federal opposition party, even has it part of its platform to outlaw the idea that there might be any sort of therapeutic response to issues dealing with transgender. And, of course, we had our same-sex marriage debate late last year, and same-sex marriage is now law in Australia. When we talk about a therapeutic response, what is happening in your neck of the woods in the US? What sorts of things will you be sharing with Australian audiences when you visit next week? Give us an idea of how you approach this issue.
Well, there are essentially two avenues of approach. There's the avenue of approach that Dr. Kenneth Zucker, who I mentioned previously, had 30-plus years of experience with about 600 patients total. And he used intense counseling to bring these delusional people back to a state of essentially mental health, where they recognized by his intervention, and it was counseling and counseling alone, that by the time they went through their pubertal status in adolescence and became young adults, 98% of boys and upwards of 80% of girls chose to identify themselves as the sex they were born. And that's a phenomenal success rate in terms of interventions bringing around good mental health. So that is the standard whereby I use and recommend to patients, is to find the counselors that will essentially help you go back through the trauma, through the things that led you astray, and come back to reality. The other side of the coin is the transgender movement, which is essentially working politically to get laws passed to outlaw such return to mental health that way. And instead, they are demanding that schools, families, medical societies, and physicians in general affirm the fact that the child believes they're in the wrong body, with counseling not for the child so much as counseling for all the terrible people around in the families and society who view this as abnormal. So the counseling is basically aimed at getting everyone to accept the fact that this child is actually, even though they are a boy, wants to be a girl, and then should be treated as a girl, should be called female pronouns, female names, should be dressed as a female. So affirmation counseling is number one, followed by, at the point of entry into puberty, blocking puberty from happening altogether. And the purpose for that is that the sense is that one of the most agonizing times for transgender kids is working through puberty and coming to a realization how unhappy they are. And in the case of Dr. Zucker's work and our concept, to work them through adolescence and let the hormones of puberty that are their own natural hormones bring them back around to their identity as the sex they were born. But the affirmation crowd wants to block puberty as if it's a disease state that causes pain and agony and should be avoided. Well, there are many things about adolescence that cause agony. The life of a 12, 13, and 14-year-old child in their school societies and amongst their friends is often full of angst and questions about who they are and where they're going, and they have acne to deal with. So should we block puberty for all children so that they don't have to have any kind of suffering? And the answer, of course, is absolutely not. That would be, we all can view that as sort of a bit of insanity. So blocking puberty, and then in the midst of that, beginning to introduce the hormones of the opposite sex in large enough doses to begin to make physical changes, all of this being done before the age of consent, which in the United States is 18 years. So you're asking an adolescent who really has very little clue about long-term planning and forecasting and abstract thought to make a decision that they want to change their body, that they want to take the risk of essentially total infertility, heart disease, cancers, early death, and by what we know from the prior experience in Sweden, if they do all of this, they'll end up essentially with a 20-fold risk of killing themselves as a suicide. So we need to explain that to these children. But the people on that on the transgender movement side just poo-poo that and say, oh, that's not going to happen. We believe, and we want to believe, that happiness will occur and that this child will then grow up and be a perfectly happy human being because all that was wrong was they were born into the wrong body. Following the hormone blocking of puberty and cross-sex hormones is mutilating surgery, removing breasts in females, trying to create a surgical penis somehow with technology and the 3D printing, and et cetera, taking the penis and scrotum and testicles out of the boys and creating an artificial vagina, and thereby making a, what I call a permanent costume, which is an impersonation of a female or an impersonation of a male, but not really internally, biologically, anything other than the sex they were born. So they are pushing this agenda, indicating that that's what they believe would be best. Have they any evidence whatsoever? And the answer is unequivocally not a shred of evidence. As a matter of fact, the evidence shows that when the patients are treated medically and surgically, their outcomes as young adults are good for about 10 years, and then past 10 years, they come to the reality in their life for whatever reason. Perhaps it's their religious faith coming back into their life and making them realize they have made a tragic mistake, which they cannot undo without great difficulty, and they have to go, you know, they're stuck in a physical body that is not them, a mutilated body, a hormone-changed body, a cancer risk body, an infertile body. And so God's plan comes back to them, and whether or not they intended it to or not, God talks to all of us in many ways and indicates these individuals, or perhaps if they're not faithful and don't have a faith in God, they don't know where it comes from, but their agony is epical, and they take their lives 20 times more than the general population takes their lives. This is concrete science, and it's just so tragic to think that we want to create what we've learned from a small population, and which is now almost a fanatic cult on the internet, to involve 3% of the world's population by doing this. It's just, it's a tragedy that takes my breath away.
Okay, and no doubt there'll be people who'll be wanting to see you deliver some of these things personally, and you will be in Australia next week on a national tour of capital cities. A lot of people will be wanting to see you deliver these things and the sorts of things that you'll deliver that might not come up in a conversation like ours today. We're taking calls on 1-800-316-316. Let's hear from Les in Corowa in New South Wales, just 2.5 minutes out from news. But Les, welcome along. What are your thoughts? Les, are you with us? Les is not with us. Okay, Les, you might like to call us back. 1-800-316-316. I'll remind you, too, you could leave a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/visionradio. So, Quentin, when you've got mutilation surgery that creates this permanent costume, the health risks that come along with that, heart disease, cancer, you mentioned early death, not to mention the 20 times more likely probability of the possibility of suicide. And these things are the concrete science, not the cult that you're talking about, a philosophical cult belief. This controversy is causing such confusion, and I wonder what you sort of see as a way forward. Just 90 seconds out from the news.
Well, I would say that I think if we educate the population not to be afraid to speak out in terms of their own personal beliefs, and to meld it with medical science and allow medical scientists to not be afraid to speak out. That's the problem, is that I think in the United States, amongst my colleagues, they are absolutely morbidly afraid of ruining their medical careers because they would lose their academic position or their credentials for taking an opinion so controversial as ours or mine on this side. So, prayer and getting together and communicating, presenting the compassionate side of this issue. We are not asking transgender kids to suffer and just go away and not come back. We want to help them in a really concrete way.
Dr. Quentin Van Meter is a clinical associate professor of pediatrics in both Emory University and Morehouse Schools of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, in the US. He is on the phone with us from Atlanta, Georgia. And Quentin, we'll take some calls in just a few moments, but just let me reflect a moment, a couple of Facebook comments that have come through. One from Peter, who says, why get involved in other people's nonsense? Or even talk about it. And another comment from Peter, opposite Peter from Colin, that's a hot topic that will increasingly demand consideration and correct attitude. I wonder whether you've got a comment. There's two different positions there. Of course, the correct attitude idea is probably where we're headed. What are your thoughts for those Facebook guests?
Well, I would, the second gentleman who says, you know, it is a topic that needs attention to be able to get us to the right direction, I fully agree with him. The first gentleman, Peter, I would say, as human beings, it's very hard, particularly those of us in the field of medicine, who are in our purpose of life and our passion is to heal the sick. And when we see sickness around, it's very difficult for most of us to not address that and to come forward and help. And so why should we be involved? Well, it's kind of in our DNA, I guess. If we chose to be in the medical field, let us take care of that. If it's out of the zone of comfort of others, just pray for us that we do the right thing, and we will very much appreciate those prayers.
There's often an accusation that comes against people who hold to a Christian faith that somehow or other we're the ones living in the fantasy world. I suspect where Peter might be enlightened is that there's a fantasy world that's going on, and it's the Christians who are the ones who are endeavouring to bring about some concrete reality here. That's a significant issue. When we talk about this concrete reality, the idea of there being research and this thing that people are coming up with now saying, oh, there's new research or there's new findings, new surveys that are all sort of in favour of this philosophical cult, as we've been calling it, called transgenderism. But let me just ask you, Quentin, with your experience, and I think you said 40-odd years experience in your role as a professor in what you're doing, the basis for research studies, how can we be trusting the studies that are already there that demonstrate this idea that you're arguing?
Well, I think, first of all, anytime you look at how science, the scientific method, the classic in research is to have a theory that you would like to either prove or disprove. You have a means of testing with a control group, that is to say, a group of patients who would be treated in the theoretical way, and a group of patients that would be treated as the current standard of care, absent these recommended new changes, and you select these patients randomly. They are not chosen because they are interested in being in one group or not. They are recruited to a study saying you will be assigned randomly to one or the other, and you will accept that. Are you willing to do so? Then those subjects are divided, and a random choice is given to them to have a group of essentially matched for age, socioeconomic status, if you can, gender, obviously. And you go ahead and put a protocol forward that says we will do the following things and we will have assessments along the way. And if there is any degree of harm that happens to any of the study subjects, it will immediately stop the study. Everything will be reviewed by an independent group of individuals, what we call an institutional review board. They will call the shots and say the researcher might have been very passionate about his or her belief in what the study was supposed to show, but we're not going to use that passion as a judgment tool. We are going to be use independent safety criteria. And if there is harm done, the study will be stopped and it will be done. The patients are aware that this could happen, and if there is no harm, they go to the next step along the way. Measures are taken very frequently to look for safety and efficacy, and then there is a timeline where they expect to see sustainable results. In the case of transgenderism, that would have to be a 30-year study because that is where it's been proven between 20 and 30 years out is where things have fallen apart with the previous research that's been published. So what's happened in the United States and other countries is they're designing studies that are a year long. They have no control groups. They just push all the patients in. They are recruited into the study because they advertise and they pick up people who are strongly believing that their children should be essentially treated. There's no control group that's pushed forward. And at the end of the first year, they ask the parents to review how happy their children are. And 100% of the families say, oh, my children are very happy. So that publishes the first paper, Transgender Affirmation Causes Wonderful Happiness. Okay, it's ridiculous. It's science designed to essentially affirm your presupposed hypothesis without having any independence or overview or oversight, and having not a shred of care about any potential harm. So, you know, what we have in the literature is the beautiful study is from Sweden, and it was published in 2012. This is a study of absolutely every single patient in the country of Sweden who was transgendered and was treated with hormones and subsequently with surgery. In the Scandinavian countries with socialized healthcare, everybody's data is available. They didn't recruit people into the study. They took every patient, warts and all, and they looked at the outcomes at the other end. They did not have a control group, but they just published what happened to 100% of the patients that were involved. And what happened was disaster. So this is a study that it's been tried to be refuted by the trans activist community as a terrible study that didn't show much of anything at all, and the authors were castigated amongst their peers, and the authors actually, as I understand, were told to retract the article, and they did not do so. So it's politics moving in to push things that are under the appearance of research. There are studies that show that when they look at the MRI studies of the brain of transgendered men and transgendered women, that they are anatomically more similar to the sex that they wished to be than they are of their natal sex. But this is taking a single snapshot of a patient who has lived a life whose brain has been patterned to socially adapt and hormonally change artificially, and looking at the brain and saying, oh, this patient was born this way. This is an evidence of anatomical roots of this problem, and that it has biologic basis. And it is, of course, patent nonsense. You cannot prove that at all. What we would need to prove that is that we would need to take a population of newborn males and females, do serial MRI scans on them every year, and watch what happens. And if they happen to be transgendered, we would see whether or not there was a difference in their brain development over time from the very beginning of this issue, as opposed to seeing them when they're in their 30s or 40s. When the brain, the plastic neuroplasticity of the brain, can change based on environmental influence.
So Quentin, there's a way to do real science, and the way that the philosophic cult of transgender is looking at their surveys and research, it doesn't measure up to what real science demands. Let's take a call. We've got a caller waiting patiently on the line from Sydney. So it's an anonymous caller. Hello, welcome along. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yes, good morning. I just wanted to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing. My own personal experience is that I had an identity crisis. I was abused for years, up to the age of 10, sexually abused. By the time I was 15, I was very confused. I was quite scared, and I didn't know what I was. I actually hated self. I love what you say, is that you say we have to reach out to the people with these challenges. I'm now 60, almost 60, and I've been dealing over the last year with a lot of the challenges that came out of that. I think what I tried to do was to say, if I could just be that, if I could be just something else, my life would feel better. Is that the sort of, that's where I came from, that's where I feel.
Let's get a thought or two from Dr. Quentin on our caller and his experience.
Well, I'm not a trained clinical psychologist, but the story you tell about trying to find a solution to figure out who you are in actuality is a common thread that I have seen in the patients that have come to my office. There is always an angst and a yearning to find some sort of happiness, and you know, it's the human condition. I think we look for positive things that will solve problems, and you've had this lifelong struggle. And I would say that you know, you need to be a brave and outspoken person, and I say that as you're an anonymous caller, and I fully respect that. But what we need in order to have a bulwark of evidence on our side to say there is harm being done when you affirm and you do the cross-sex hormones and you suggest surgery is that the folks that have done that have regrets, are now beginning to come out from the woodwork and say, I can't hold this in any longer. I'm afraid that I might be harmed by the activists, but it is my life, and I wanted to share my experience and say, be brave, find the therapist that you need, find out who you are. If you are a person of faith, use your faith to guide you. And I would say congratulations to you for working your whole life so hard, coming through all of the trauma that you faced, and don't give up. You know, find a colleague in the field of medicine and counseling who will embrace you and take you to a good place.
Thank you so much to that caller from Sydney. We're taking calls 1-800-316-316. Let's hear from Jeanette in Albury. Hello, Jeanette. Welcome along.
Thank you. Good morning. I just want to say I really appreciate your courage of your guest, Quentin, and thank you for his knowledge and the science that is behind it and his medical qualifications. And I will be praying for you when you're in Australia that you will not be, you know, have any awful people protesting or trying to cut it, you know, stop it happening.
Jeanette, thank you so much for your call and your encouragement. And let me encourage listeners who have been inspired or had their understanding enlarged by listening to this conversation that it will be available on a podcast later today. And there may be people that you know who will appreciate hearing these thoughts. And you, as I mentioned, you do have to listen carefully to catch some of the deeper issues when it comes to the medical side of this issue of transgender. Thank you so much, Jeanette, for your call. Let's take a call from Bobby in Melbourne. Hello, Bobby. Welcome along.
Hello. Yes, I'm transgender. I'm in my 60s. I've always been happy. Now, as to that Swedish study, if you look at the people from 1973 to 1988 compared to those from 1989 to 2003, then all the rates like suicide attempt went down from 7.9 to 2. Any death went down from 3.1 to 1.9. And that as society's attitudes become more accepting, well, of course, people don't experience so much pressure. They, you know, for example, a lot of these things like homelessness, for example, well, a lot of that homelessness is caused because the parents throw their transgender child out of home.
Bobby, let's keep on the initial point you're making, and I want to just thank you so much for having the courage to call in when we're discussing something that's opposite to your appreciation of what's been reality for you. And as you say, you're approaching 60. Let's get a thought or two from Quentin on the way that sometimes we look at statistics. Some people look at statistics and see something completely different. What are your thoughts for Bobby from Melbourne?
Well, I appreciate his call, and I appreciate the fact that he has the courage to bring a question and actually have a dialogue, which is a wonderful thing. I would say that the subsequent follow-up has not had patients, you know, in the treatment arm as long as the original study. Sweden is a country that has been accepting of the transgender concept for a long time, and so it is not a societal pressure issue which causes suicidal activity, but is their own internal struggle. So it's again, there is a tendency to blame society for suicidal deaths of patients in the transgender community, when indeed that statistic does not bear out. Suffering from discrimination on the basis of race and economic status does not create the same degree of suicidality, if you will. So I think it's, again, it's how you look at the statistics and the data. The study that it was just published from the Netherlands ostensibly showing that there is no increase in suicide rate. It actually took a population in the Netherlands of patients who volunteered their data. That wasn't like the Swedish study, everybody. It was those who expressed an interest and wanted to be contacted to see how they felt. And they stopped the study evaluation at 9 years in, not anything past 10 years. And we already know that there is a sense of peace and tranquility that lasts for a while after the decision is made. And this gentleman who called has lived to the age of 60 in peace and tranquility, and that is a wonderful thing that he can do so. And I wish him well and hope that he has continued peace and that he never has to face the concept of sort of an internal struggle that would make him consider taking his life. So my prayers go out to him. I would care for him with all due respect, if no matter what his own personal philosophy was.
Bobby from Melbourne, appreciate you calling in and sharing your story. We are racing through some calls. Time is running out, but let's take a caller from Sydney, another anonymous call. Hello, welcome along.
Hello, would that be me?
It's you, yes.
Oh, okay. I just thank the doctor very much for his opinions. Someone very close to me has identified as transgender and has transitioned in the fourth decade of life, which is, of course, very hurtful as a parent because I'm a Christian. But I have always believed that this was a delusion, and so thank you for affirming this for me. I would like to ask the question, once hormones are introduced, and I know there's neuroplasticity in the brain, what impact do these have on the brain, and how difficult is it then for someone to come out of that lifestyle?
Okay, I need a quick response from Dr. Quentin
sure.
Van Meter.
So the idea, I cannot speak to the exact anatomic changes due to the change in hormones, other than the receptors in the brain are programmed from intrauterine life moving forward to be identified as male or female, responding to male hormones or female hormones in a certain way. For the adult, it's a very long and arduous process, more on the social side, from what I understand of those who've written their books about their regret and their wish to come back to their natal sex. So it's a very complex issue.
Thank you so much to that caller. And to pick up on one final question from a Facebook contribution from Antonella, who asks a question, Quentin, should a Christian teacher address the students as per their biological gender, a neutral gender, or the adopted one if the student wants to be addressed by their not biological gender? When you were saying a little earlier on, issues to do with, speaking like a truthfulness, speaking a way into people's life that doesn't reinforce the delusion. What are your thoughts for Antonella?
Well, it's being a compassionate person and someone of faith, I would say I would have a private conversation with that child and let them know that it is your hope and prayer that they will work through their concern and confusion, and that what you would like to do is come to an agreement, perhaps not to get in a position to have to use any pronouns or a name that would insinuate the new identity the child wishes to speak, in order to protect the child from harm from peers, teasing, and also to protect the child from internalizing that this is a normal state. So I think it's best to be very forthright with a child and come to a private agreement, student and teacher, involving, of course, the parents. You must let the parents know your intentions. and say, we are protecting the child, and the child needs to live in an environment where this is not, by the majority of people, not accepted as a normal state, and by a number of the medical community as a normal state, and we wish to do no harm. And so by affirming, we feel and believe personally that is doing harm. How can we come to some sort of a mutual circumstance where we don't even really have to address the child's gender at all?
Well, I want to thank everyone who's called in on our talkback line, and to those who've made a question or contribution on our Facebook page. Time has run out, but I do want to mention where those who are in capital cities around Australia will be able to see Dr. Quentin Van Meter speak next week. He's going to be in Sydney on Monday, that's the 13th of August, at the Australian Family Association office. He'll be in Canberra on Tuesday, the 14th, at Old Parliament House. In Melbourne on Wednesday at St. Francis Xavier Parish Hall in Box Hill, Brisbane on Thursday the 16th at the Tattersalls Club in the CBD, and in Perth on Friday the 17th at the Social Sciences Lecture Theatre at the University of WA. And Dr. Quentin Van Meter is being sponsored to this tour in Australia by the Australian Family Association. There's a website there, and if you're interested in going along to those and you want to affirm some details and time, you'll need to get those from the website family.org.au. That's family.org.au. Dr. Quentin Van Meter is a clinical associate professor of pediatrics at two universities in Atlanta, Georgia. Quentin, thank you so much for taking some time to share your thoughts, your wisdom, your heartbeat with us today on 2020.
Well, I appreciate your having me on, and I appreciate the prayers of everyone who expressed those and may have them in their hearts as well. It will give me great strength to do what I feel I am supposed to do on the side of the issue.
Dr. Quentin Van Meter.
Before you go, thanks for listening.
There's lots more great audio on demand, or you can listen to us live at visionradio.org.au.
And remember, Vision is listener supported. Your donation,
large or small,
will help us continue connecting faith to life for hundreds of thousands of people across Australia and around the world.
Learn more or donate today at visionradio.org.au.